The South African jazz trumpet player Hugh Masekela is our guest today. He has a new album, Revival, at least the 32nd in his career, and it stretches back to the early 1960s. Masekela left South Africa in 1961 and, with some help from Harry Belafonte and Dizzy Gillespie, settled in the U.S. As a youngster in South Africa, he picked the trumpet to play after seeing the film Young Man with a Horn. In talking with him about his early influences, I asked Hugh if Louis Armstrong was one of those influences. Both he and Hugh sing and play.
Louis Armstrong took away everybody's inhibitions about singing. When we were kids, we all walk around singing, "I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal," you know. When I started my band, I came here as a bebop player. And, you know, bebopers who were very cool. We wore dark glasses and hid behind the mic. It didn't even, like, show any emotions. And when I was teaching my first group the songs, I had to sing them to them. And they said, and at the time I was married to Miriam McGavin, and they all said, "It's either you sing or we don't play." And she said also, "It's either you sing or I don't marry," you know, just before we got married. But everybody said, "We sing so great." And I was like, hey, the last thing I want to do is sing. So the first time, in fact, it was on that album, the first time I started singing at the Village Gate, the first day I had to sing, I had like cotton mouth. I was sweating. And I just felt very, very strange. And when people applauded, I was very surprised. I still get surprised.
What you're pointing to is I have a reissue of an album came out in 65 here called The Americanization of Ooga Booga. Well, you better explain what you meant by the title, because you know, that's like Tarzan language to me.
Yeah, well, Tom Wilson, the producer of the album, said, "Hey, man, what are we going to call this?" And at the time, there was a movie called The Americanization of Emily. It was a very big movie. And people were still like struggling to identify with what Africa was really about. And we were some of the first immigrants to come in. And people, you know, used to ask me, "What do you eat? Do you have trees? Do you live in houses?" and stuff like that. So I always made fun of the ignorance about Africa, and he loved it. So let's call it the Americanization of Ooga Booga, and we made fun in the cover, too, because I have a Wall Street Journal and a briefcase and a Brooks Brothers suit and barefooted. And a lot of people, actually, like 2-3 years later, you know, I'd meet women who said, "Oh, I've always wanted to meet you, but I'm so disappointed now you're wearing shoes. You've really gotten Americanized."
Well, the interesting thing about the album is everybody talks about the fusions of, you know, world music and combining African and certainly from other cultures with Western music. You did it on this record a long time ago, and it didn't seem like it was any kind of a stretch.
Well, I mean, when I came, I was, like I said, a bebop a musician and a jazz musician. I grew up in township dance bands. And I started music when I was 3 years old, playing the gramophone. And everybody, well, Miriam Makeba and Harry Belafonte brought me to school in the States, and then they introduced me to Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis and all. And I was trying to get a job either with the Jazz Messengers or with Horace Silver if Blue Mitchell got sick. And they all said, "Why don't you start your own group?" You know? And they all advised me to say, "If you're going to be a jazz musician, you're just going to be a statistic like all of us. But if you put some infusion of some of the music or most of the music from your country or from your, you know, traditional backgrounds, you're going to stand out just like Miriam Makeba or Latunji does, you know." And I sort of regretted at the time why I didn't immerse myself more in ethnic and traditional music when I was back home instead of American music. Not that I didn't know it, but I slowly came up with a hybrid, and a lot of it was helped by Miriam Makeba, whose mother was a traditional healer and who had a major, major anthology of like traditional South African music. And between her and her daughter, we used to sing all these songs. And I was able to like come up with something that people seem to like. And I've been trying to, I've been going back ever since. Now I'm completely immersed in whatever is old.
That's interesting. You know, you go from being immersed in the American culture to going back and becoming immersed in your own. For your own. Can you let's play the first one, which is your then wife Miriam Makeba's composition.
Zeno Ribeiro.
Yeah,
Zeno Ribeiro.
Here he is on stage at the Village Gate.
Yeah.
In 1965.
Right.
When the young men are recruited from the countryside of South Africa to come and work in the gold mines of Johannesburg, in the packed trains that carry them from the mines, or rather from the country to the mines, they usually sing many songs reminiscing of times of old. This is one such song, and it speaks of the times of our forefathers when the sky was the roof and the ground was the floor, and things were much less complicated. Zeno Ribeiro. Whoa, ah, yeah, la la, ah, 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 you know, Ramiro, Drawes, no, Tobo, ah, Tumbo, Gababo, Vernana, oh, you know, you live at the end with my food, you know, Ramiro, Drawes, no, you
Hugh Masekela, that's not the new album he has out called Revival, but that's a recent reissue of a couple of groundbreaking albums in 1965, which are re-released under the title of The Lasting Impression of Ooga Booga. Two albums that came out on either side of Grazing in the Grass being a hit. I think one of them was kind of, you know, say, hey, we better catch the Hugh Masekela train before it leaves the station. Can we backtrack just a little bit, Hugh, to talk a little bit about, maybe if you could contrast for people, because you were in such an amazing position. You left South Africa in
1960. Yeah.
Went to England first and then later came here.
Right.
Can you describe what it was like for you, just as a human being and as a musician then, and then contrast it for when you went back after apartheid had been lifted?
Well, I left South Africa when it was, at the beginning of the peak of repression. It was just right after the Sharpeville massacre. And I had been waiting for a passport for 3 years, and I was in a very, probably the most famous popular group in South Africa, jazz group called the Jazz Epistle. And after the Sharpeville massacre, where, you know, 69 people were shot in the back, when thousands of people had peacefully congregated at the municipal offices in Sharpeville to protest the raising of the rents and the carrying of the identification passbooks, the first state of emergency was proclaimed, and gatherings of more than 10 people were illegalized, so we couldn't play anymore. And a month later, I got my passport. And Father Huddleston, Bishop Huddleston in England, who had been deported 5 years before, helped me to come to England through the help of Yehudi Menuhin and Johnny Dankworth, and got me into the Guildhall School of Music. Mm. Then Miriam Makeba, the year before, just attained major success here, and she was a childhood friend, and she was an ex-girlfriend, and she brought me to the States with the help of Belafonte. And when I came here during like the top, the very, very peak of the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King and the emergence of Malcolm X, and I arrived here when Nixon and Kennedy were campaigning. My mentors were people who were into civil rights, Belafonte and Miriam Makeba, and I was influenced a lot by Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, and Miles, who all like were very much activists.
Mm-hmm.
And long story short, finally things changed in South Africa, and they said we could come back. And when I came back, it was just a wonderful miracle, because it gave me a chance to re-immerse myself in a lot of things that had to be fixed and a lot of things that I hadn't been involved in. But I think the interesting part was to see how much damage had been done by apartheid over the 30 years that I had gone. And the population had quadrupled, but you actually saw the effects of the reshuffling of people, the impoverishment of people, and the systematic manipulation of the death of their traditional excellence. Because if you impoverish people and take their lands away, they cannot practice who they really are, and they can be homogenized. And I think of all the things, of the poverty and everything, the thing that really broke my heart most was the homogenization of people. I would say the homogenization of Ooga Booga. Through radio and television and advertising, people have actually abandoned their Africanness, their African and their culture. And I think that was systematically manipulated by the apartheid government, because they figured if you're going to separate people, then you can't have them admiring each other. You can't have mutual admiration. And mutual admiration was really damaged. And I think what we're all working on, including the government especially, is to reinstill in people mutual admiration and pride in their traditional origins.
Well, I would love to talk about how that... what that does to music. One of the things you talk about on this new album, Revival, is the rise of, it's a Kwaito?
Kwaito, yeah.
Kwaito,
yeah.
Which is, you seem to equate with South African hip-hop in a way. And does it take any traditional elements? And what about it is particularly South African?
Well, it is really no different from the music we're playing in dance bands and music that Miriam Makeba and the Manhattan Brothers, the singing quartets and girl trios of those days were doing. Although we were influenced when I left by jazz, the influence of rhythm and blues, the influence of disco, and then the influence of rap and hip-hop affected the urban music. And basically... it's really township, the old township music decorated with the new influences.
I wanted to play a piece from it that the Zwei and Goofy produced, District 6. What does that mean? What is District 6?
District 6 was an area like Sophiatown. It was one of the areas that was forcibly, where Africans lived, and they were forcibly removed from the center of town to go and live in remote areas. And after we got free, District 6 was revived, and the people who lived there began to come back. So it says, we're going back to District 6. It's a celebration of that. But what is ironical about that is that the girl who's singing with us is a 17-year-old Afrikaner girl who has an unbelievable voice. And, the Afrikaners were the people of apartheid, and she sings in Zulu. Yeah, and she can sing soul, she can sing anything, which again shows you that, people are forced into categories, even socially, culturally, and racially. But most people, I think most children, when they grow up, just want to be human beings.
Guest is Hugh Masekela, and that is District 6, which is one you'll find on Revival, a new album he has out, as we mentioned, his first one in 3 years. And her name is?
Her name is Corlea. Corlea Buota.
You're so much connected with what's going on now. I hate to take you back into the past, but there's some questions I've always had. One of them is, going all the way back to the Monterey Pop Festival. You played at the Monterey mm-hmm, Pop Festival. Mm-hmm. Were you one of the few jazz groups to play there?
Yeah, well, at the time I wasn't considered. People were very confused about what I really was because right. Being a black artist at the time, I was doing a lot of protests, what was considered protests and social consciousness songs. And I think the only person who was doing that at the time was Miriam McGavin, Bob Dylan, and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and right. Joan Baez, and Harry Belafonte. You know, it was a handful, but it was an unpopular thing to do, especially after, like, the McCarthy hearings, and, you know, Pete Seeger and all those people were blacklisted. And people were like, why are you doing this, you know? I mean, aren't you afraid? I said, I can't be afraid because it's difficult to come from a people who are oppressed and not sing about them.
Now, well, was your music, did it get back to Africa? Even though you didn't, did it get back to either South Africa or Africa in general?
Oh, yeah, it got to all over Africa. Even though it was banned in South Africa, it was smuggled in, you know. And what the government used to do is that they because the South African Broadcasting Corporation was the only broadcasting medium in South Africa, and if there was a funny track that they didn't like on the LP, they just scratch, you know, with a nail, they destroy that side. But people still could buy copies. It's just that they couldn't be broadcast. But it was, if it had a certain track, it was illegal to get. So people played it privately. And when I went back to South Africa, a lot of people said to me, "You got me arrested." I said, "Why?" I said, "Because I was found with your album." You know.
Music, the most subversive of the arts.
Right. And I think I still have about 20 albums that haven't been released yet in South Africa. They never even got to South Africa because they were just banned outright.
Huh. Well, I have to ask about Grazing in the Grass because I understand for you it was just something that happened at the end of a session, but it ended up... It's just hard to believe nowadays that instrumental pieces can be such huge hits as they were back at that point. Mm-hmm. You were surprised at its... at its success, or
yeah, I mean, great. We did an album called I think it was maybe my fifth or sixth album called "The Promise of a Future," and Russ Regan from Universal, where I was, came in and to listen to the record, finished album, and he said, "You know, I think you need another track here." And the tenor saxophone player Ella Bro in our group really was crazy about track and loved it, and he said, "Why don't we do that track with a cowbell?" You know, and we did it, we learned it, because it was very simple, you know. The bass player had only four notes to play, the drummer had one, and all the guitar had to play was down, 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 the piano player, dun. So I showed them quickly, and we put it together, and there was an old friend of mine who was playing with Phil Ox, Bruce Langhorne, and he's a guitar player who, when I was a student, used to come and listen to all the South African music, so he knew it, and I said, "Bruce, can you take a break and come and play the guitar part?" We overdubbed his part, and then he held the cowbell, and I hit it. And in half an hour, we had the song, and in an hour's time, we mixed it. That evening, we played it for Russ Regan. He said, "This is a smash." But, you know, I'd never really aimed at singles. I didn't even know how you made them. And this song, I just figured, he said, "It's going to be a smash." I said, "What's a smash?" You know, so I thought it was going to be a flop.
Well, it's one everybody knows from my guest today, Hugh Masekela. There's a period in your music that I guess I call kind of a funk period, and I'm thinking about something that's still popular nowadays, is the song "The Boy's Doing It." What was the origin of that one?
Well, it was less funk than it was fun. I think we were playing at Lansing, Michigan, and I had this group from it was now Hedgeless Sons are sort of broken up, and some of the members of Hedgeless Sons stayed, and they got some of their other friends who were in Washington. We were working out of Washington, then a couple of them were at Howard. They were musicians. And we put together a group, and we did an album called The Boy Is Doing It.
Right.
But we were backstage at Lansing. We just finished a concert at Michigan State, and we're backstage partying and having a great time. And we just started singing the song, The Boy Is Doing It, boy. And we're fooling around, and somebody said, why don't we record that? And so we made up like more little lyrics for it, and it became the song that Neil Bogart loved, you know, and they said, we're going to call this The Boy Is Doing It, and we're going to push this song. And it's still like one of the most popular songs in our repertoire.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, let's...
But the fun things always seem to take off, you know.
Human nature. Let's listen to a little bit of this one, if some folks remember. The Boy Is Doing It. We've been talking with Hugh Masekela, talking about music and the many things that have gone on in his life. So one thing I haven't talked about, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about it, is when Paul Simon's Graceland tour in the mid-'80s, you were one of the first to defend Paul Simon when he was attacked for violating the ANC boycott. What was your reasoning on that?
Well, I first met Paul Simon through Tom Wilson. Tom Wilson, who produced the Americanization of Ooga Booga. And we're sort of like distant friends, you know, when we met each other. And then when he was going to go and record Graceland in Johannesburg, he was looking for me, but I told him, hey, I can't go to Johannesburg and I'm not involved. So I said, well, when he came back, he said, listen, I did this thing, and I'm going to get into a little... And I said, well, let me hear it. And I was just really knocked out by what he did. And what I knew from the cultural boycott was that people were not supposed to play in South Africa, but there was nothing about recording. Then for me, like people who were promoting South African musicians overseas, you know, and promoting South African music was a plus for us. Because of Graceland... By 1987, there was nobody who was recording an album without either having a song about Mandela or an anti-apartheid song. So for me, it had a major, major influence on conscientizing the world about apartheid. And I just said, anybody who is against this guy has to be crazy, because first of all, he shared, you know, the composition credits,
right,
and royalties, you know, with Ray Peary and Black Mambas and all these guys, and he wasn't exploiting anybody. And my thing was like, if we're going to complain about this, then we're going to have to complain about the Beatles, and we have to complain about the Rolling Stones, and complain about Elvis Presley, who also exploited genres that they didn't come from, and those people's songs. I have always in my life tried to like stick to my beliefs. This is something that I learned from growing up in the struggle, and from Miriam Makeba and Harry Belafonte, and especially Miles Davis, who never bit his tongue and was always very straight. So if you don't like a thing, you just got to say you don't like it, man. You know, you can't try and find out what the advantages are of liking or not liking it, because later on, if you're wrong, you're going to be feeling pretty stupid, is how you put it.
Hugh, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm sorry that I spoke you to death.
I'm still alive. Hugh Masekela, my guest today on the World Cafe.
Our thanks again to Hugh Masekela for joining us today on the World Cafe. That new album is called Revival.